Hi friends, nothing medical this week, but I did want to let you know that we will be discussing various plot points of the book Semiosis by Sue Burke. So if you don't want to know any of the plot before you have a chance to read the book, I highly recommend that you give it a read and then come back and enjoy this episode and the conversation when you are able and ready. And if you are up for listening to the episode and have read the book or don't care about hearing the plot before you read it, then please enjoy. And here's the theme song by Jonathan Colton. DNA, you're in my heart. DNA, infector in every part of my body. Cell has a nucleus, each nucleus is chromosome. DNA, baby, that spells DNA. Hi, and welcome to episode 21 of BioBreak, a conversation with your friendly neighborhood biologist.
I'm Andy Walsh. I'm joined, as always, by my wife, Jody.
Hi there.
How you doing, Jody?
Technology is fun.
Yeah. We had some adventures. We've been moving some things around in our home to get more permanent space for working at home and schooling at home and all that fun stuff and some new devices. So a little bit more excitement. And also because we have an extra guest with us this week. And so we had a little bit different setup for that as well. My dad, Patrick Walsh, is also joining us.
Hi, everyone.
What would you like the folks to know about you?
Oh, gee. I spent my career, I'm not a biologist, I'm not a doctor, I don't play one on television. I spent my career in educational publishing, college textbook publishing. I still have my hand in that work as a freelancer, but I have freelance work being what it is, I have time to do other things, including join you for this recording. So thank you for inviting me.
Sure, we're glad to have you. And so we thought, so this week we're going to do something a little bit different. We're talking about a science fiction novel. So I thought having somebody with some background in writing and literature and so forth would also be helpful. And you're also an avid gardener, amateur botanist, something along those lines. So the book we're discussing this week is Semiosis by Sue Burke, a science fiction novel about exploring another planet. Folks from Earth are exploring and eventually, over the course of the novel, discover that the primary intelligence on that planet is not animal-based or animal-descended, but plant-descended. So I thought that was a really interesting take. There's not as many biology-focused science fiction stories. There's a lot of space stories and where there may be aliens, but the biology of the aliens is not really the focus of the story. There's a lot of, you know, computers and robot stories and things like that and new energy sources. But oftentimes it, you know, if you get a biology story, it's about a disease that's going to kill us all or a zombie.
It's all those fun bits of biology.
Right. A zombie apocalypse that's going to do us all in or something like that.
No, this was very fascinating because also like in other stories where they're on other planets, it's about you kind of forcing Earth things into that planet. And this kind of took a very different, this group that landed on this planet, took a different direction where they were trying to work with the environment more directly as opposed to take it over.
Well, they kind of had to work with or figure out what was going on in the environment, because early in the book, the plant life managed to kill two of the members of the Earth, the settlers from Earth. So even though they had previously eaten the fruit of that plant, they ate it one more time and it killed two of them. So they had to figure out what was going on with the plant life.
Yes, that's kind of a basic assumption of a lot of science fiction stories, is that if you get to another planet, our biology will be compatible with at the very least, the plant life, right? Even if there's not animals to hunt, or even if there's some reluctance to, you know, kill local native species for meat, there's an assumption that, well, we can at least eat the plants. And yet, you know, because the plants, as I ultimately discovered, because the plants are intelligent and have a lot of control over the biochemistry of their fruit, that's not a it's not a straightforward assumption, or that's not a valid assumption, as it turns out. I think that brought up some interesting facets of plant biology on Earth, the way that plants are able to incorporate neuroactive or psychoactive chemicals in their fruits, in their leaves, as a way of interacting with, and depending on your perspective on such things and how willing you are to anthropomorphize, perhaps control things like ants or pollinators or what have you. And then some of these wind up in our diets as well, and becoming important in our diets, like caffeine and the capsaicin in spicy peppers and things.
I read a book this summer by a German author named Peter Wohlleben, and The Hidden Life of Trees. And it did exactly that. It anthropomorphized trees, talked about how trees take care of one another. And I was thinking about communicate with one another and how they also interact with the world around them. He wrote about acacia trees that will make their leaves more toxic if they're being browsed by giraffes. But the giraffes know this, have learned this, and they figured out that they can't browse the same cluster of acacia trees too soon after they've originally browsed it, because the leaves will be toxic, or at least unpleasant to the taste. So it's amazing, absolutely amazing.
Yeah, and I think there's something with eucalyptus trees and koala bears, that the koalas are sort of mildly high all the time from something that's in the eucalyptus leaves.
Yeah, that would make sense. What does the eucalyptus get out of that?
At that part I don't remember. It must be some aspect of, spreading seeds or something like that, I would imagine, but I don't remember off the top of my head.
Right. Yeah.
But that isn't. That's one of the things that I liked about the book, is that it's not just biology and botany focus, but it's a very ecological focus. It's not just about the humans and the human equivalent plants. It's about all of the different kinds of plants and some of the different animal species and how they interact with each other, and how there is some give and take and some back and forth in terms of defensive actions and offensive actions and consumption and so forth, and that there has to be some balance to that, and that the humans from Earth have to figure out a way to fit into that ecological balance as well.
Right, they can't rely on technology necessarily to do that, at least on very sophisticated technology, because some of their technology was destroyed when they tried to when they landed. And, over time, over generations, I forget how many generations semiosis covers, definitely several, but over that time, the batteries wear out and the technology wears out. So they were reduced to a pre-technology state, or sent back to, reduced isn't the right word, but sent back to a pre-technology state early on in the book.
Right. Yeah. So a lot of the solutions that we tend to look towards were not available to them, and they had to look at more biological solutions, in a sense, which is something that that comes more naturally to the plant life there, and the intelligent plant life there's one main intelligent species of bamboo, and there seems to be one single individual, at least that the colonists come in contact with, or the explorers come in contact with, who takes the name Stevland for communicating with them, and they have to work out how to communicate with it. He or they have more biological solutions to communicate, you know, questions of communication. There, you know, humans want to hook up radio waves and you know, radio devices and so forth. And right. You know, the plant has uses pigmentation to essentially create a sort of television screen. Right. You know, that sort of biological kind of approach to the same challenges.
I, you know, I think that also speaks to the broader understanding of the word technology. You know, now we think of technology, we think of the devices that we carry in our pockets that are many times more powerful than the most powerful computers even a couple of decades ago. And yet you think of crows as using technologies. They're able to fashion tools that they can use to fish insects out of crevices in trees and so on. And so it kind of broadens our, Stevelin's use of pigmentations kind of speaks to our broader understanding of what technology actually is.
Sure. And, you know, in the biochemistry that they use to influence the humans from Earth, the biochemistry that they use to influence the other plants and animals around them, that, it, you know, is a form of technology
right.
as well, if you want to think about it that way.
It seemed like it was a fascinating problem that they encountered, and there wasn't any metal that they were able to discover on the planet. And so that really limited their traditional understanding. It seemed that when they landed there, one of the things they figured was that they would eventually be able to recreate all of the you know, contemporary technology that we're used to. But how do you do that when there's no, you know, metal or mining or, you know?
Yeah, the only thing that comes close to that, it seems, is the glass blower, the work of the glass blowers. I'm sorry, glass makers. How did the glass makers develop the technology to make glass? And yet they, for some reason, they abandoned that technology and went back to, reverted to what seems like a more primitive state, what we would think of as a more primitive state.
Yeah, at least living in smaller communities. Yeah, so, you know, it's an interesting reflection on how geology can impact evolution, right? That this planet seems to have developed in such a way, developed in a different direction from the biology on our planet, possibly in part because of that lack of metal resources. And yeah, so there is this intelligent alien animal species that come to be known as the glassmakers because of the use of glass in their buildings. I never got a good picture in my head exactly of them. They're sort of insect-like, but sort of almost like kind of centaur-like is what I kept picturing in my head, in the sense that they seem to have an upper body that's more upright and
right.
and some limbs that they use as arms, as opposed to using all their limbs as legs, the way that we generally think of insects as doing. But I don't know if that's a good mental image or not, but that was kind of where I found myself going. I don't know, you're more interested in that, Jody. How did you tend to think of them?
Kind of like praying mantis type.
Yeah, that maybe is a better point of reference. Yeah, so they did construct these cities, and they did incorporate glass into their construction. But then by the time the humans from Earth encounter them, they've moved out of those cities and are living more as hunter-gatherer bands, or at least nomadic bands of family groups.
Yeah, I forget where I read it, but something I read referred to them as arthropods. But anyway, praying mantis sounds like a good picture. At least gives you a good picture of what they look
yeah.
like.
Yeah, so arthropod would be a more all-encompassing group than insects, to include things like crabs and spiders and so forth.
Right.
So yeah, and So then that, you know, that ecological aspect of the story comes in again as the bamboo, the glass makers and these humans from Earth all kind of have to figure out whether they're going to be able to coexist, how they're going to be able to coexist, what those dynamics look like, who gets what out of the relationship.
Mentioned the talking about the book as literature. You two read more science fiction and classic literature than I. Certainly more science fiction. I'm curious what your thoughts are, how it works as a work of science fiction, how it works as a as literary fiction.
I don't know. I don't know that I'm really one to address that. The science fiction I tend to read tends to be things that Andy recommends or Caleb recommends. And primarily I tend to read just to kind of, you know, connect with them in ways.
Your personal preferences are more in the fantasy direction.
Probably.
And the historical fiction direction.
I did think, and part of this is one of the things that in some of the other science fiction I've read, this idea of a story arc that goes across longer spans of time rather than, you know, one episode, I guess, you know, this kind of generational. And, you know, I think back to this Seven Eves, I guess, was another book that kind of cross generations. And so I think that's a really fascinating way to structure a story, because, you know, you get to kind of go beyond, like, when you think the story ends, it doesn't, it just continues. And so there's something that's, I think, appealing in that way of structuring. But at the same time, you know, part of, like, for me, when I reached the end of the first generation, I was like, and moved on to the next, I was like, wait, no, what else is going on here? So there were definitely those kinds of issues where, you know, I felt pulled, I guess.
Yeah, it definitely moves away from the hero's journey kind of structure of a story that has become, you know, much talked about in the wake of George Lucas's popularization of Joseph Campbell. And so, you know, a lot of stories wind up getting structured around one particular character. And so we've kind of absorbed this idea that a story is the journey of one character. One of the things that I like about science fiction is that you tend to get, because there's more of an emphasis on world building, you tend to get stories, or there is the capacity for stories or the potential for stories that span generations and that are more interested in those questions of a story is not about a person's journey. A story is about a community's journey or a civilization's journey, and what kinds of forces and dynamics and factors shape how a civilization changes over time, and what is the arc of a civilization. You know, the Asimov Foundation books are kind of a classic example of that, looking at multi-generation or extended periods of time. Like you said, Neal Stephenson, Seven Eves, is very interested in that question. This book, that was one of the things that I liked about this book, is that it did work through multiple generations. You see that this human group that's arrived has to work through solving the problems of how do you build a sustainable, lasting civilization or community, something that's going to work not just for us, but for our children and our grandchildren and so forth. And by contrast, for example, that's something I continue to be disappointed about in the most recent trilogy of Star Wars films, where they left off with, okay, the rebellion has won. Now they have an opportunity to build a civilization that reflects their values. And instead, the movies kind of walk all that back so that they can tell yet another rebelling against authority kind of story instead of. And, you know, that there's a place for that too, obviously. But I think there's a bigger challenge. You know, we kind of it's easy to recognize, or it's easier to recognize, this is something I don't like. It needs to stop. I need to undermine it in some fashion. It's much harder to figure out, how do I build something that is what I like and make it last and have it go beyond me or my generation of peers. And to that point, one of the themes that I found was interesting, or one of the points that the book brings up that I've been thinking a lot, or you know, come back to periodically thinking about the book, is at one point the bamboo organism Stevland criticizes basically all animals, both the humans from Earth and the glassmakers, that, well, they're animals, so their solution to all their problems is just move somewhere else. That, you know, if they ever get to the point where they've kind of broken their local environment enough that it's a problem, they can just pick up and move and go somewhere else. And that's kind of what the glassmakers have done by abandoning their cities. That's what the humans have done potentially by leaving Earth. We don't get a whole lot of backstory as to why they left Earth, why they've come to this other planet. But, you know, that's kind of implied, is that there's some problem on Earth that they're trying to escape. And so their solution is to come to this other planet. But the, you know, the bamboo is much more limited in that respect. It doesn't have, or they don't have the luxury of being able to say, I'm just going to pick up and find a new place. I have to fix things here. And I thought that was a very interesting theme to pick up.
Yeah, that is interesting, because you know we're in a situation now where we've with climate change that we're facing perils in the not too distant future, we can't, there is no, you know, to quote the popular meme, there is no planet B. We don't have the technology to locate another planet that might support life as we know it. You know, there is, we have to fix what we have here. Although I would say about trees that again, going back to Peter Volleben's book, he talks about trees migrating, how he talks about in connection with the Ice Age that trees migrated in advance of the advancing ice sheets, or ahead of the advancing ice sheets, and then they moved back when the ice sheets retreated. Well, we don't have glacial time like that. We have a much shorter window to create solutions that will resilient solutions for growing food and for general living now.
But yeah, that's a good point, that plants are more mobile, especially at the sort of species or group level, right? Individual plants may not be able to migrate as much, but a species can potentially migrate by having its seeds travel via wind or animals or what have you. And there is a sequel novel to Semiosis, Interference, and it gets into a little bit more. There's a few directions that it goes in, and one of them is a little bit more of what options Stevland and the bamboo in general might have, that they might not be quite as limited in terms of their motility as suggested. But we can maybe save that for another time, since I know you guys haven't had a chance to read that one yet, but just as a little teaser. Stevland is certainly in this book feels that they don't have a whole lot of options in terms of moving. They've sort of expanded. That said, you know, they do occupy quite a large spatial volume, right? It's not a single shoot of bamboo. It's a whole grove, or possibly what we might even see as multiple groves that are all one organism by virtue of connected root networks and so forth, which is another interesting aspect of plants is that the way in which, and fungus also, the way in which you can have what is essentially genetically a single organism spread out over many acres, potentially.
Yeah, aspen trees are like that.
Right.
Yeah. I did find it was hard to get a real picture of, you know, how big this planet was, how much space, because it seemed like in the initial generations, they were sticking very close to this, the one area where they started from. And even when they moved into the city, they still didn't seem to like really explore much. There were a few characters that I think that took it on themselves to go out and explore, but it didn't seem like that was a driving force. And I don't know if that was a function of there was so much energy put into, having enough food for, the society that they didn't have, the time to expend in those other pursuits, or if it was because of, the landscape that it just wasn't conducive to, broader exploration with their limited technology and tools.
Yeah, that's something I often struggle with in science fiction, is getting a sense of the scope, like planets, Star Wars has kind of often been teased for this, the way that, every planet they go to has a single sort of climate and ecosystem and so forth. And, it seems like the whole planet is basically, it's represented by one or two cities. Mm-hmm. And that's basically all that planet has to offer. It can be sometimes hard to get a planet scale sense of what we're talking about. If I had to guess, I would say that the amount of territory that gets explored in the book is like on the scale of a county, mm-hmm. an East Coast county.
Yeah.
There's kind of, like I said, there's one city and surrounding areas. And so that's kind of what I had in my head. Mm-hmm. But how much of the planet that represents? Yeah, I don't have a good feel of that.
The other thing that I found, as the artist, the other thing I found was the generation that was, basically pushing to have art be a valuable contribution to the group. I kind of was like, I was surprised that when they initially got there, that wouldn't have been one of the values kind of brought from Earth, but that they decided that no, that wasn't worthwhile time. And so the future generation, as it seemed like the progression was, each new generation had their own little way of rebelling against the parents. And the one generation was, making art and decor and, and that kind of adding those, I guess, occupations to the food gathering. And
yeah, so it's a, that's another aspect of the world building, is that because there's so few people that arrive from Earth, and they're all adults of roughly the same age, there's a strong sense of a cohort to each generation, that, they're all roughly the same age. And, there's a clear second generation, a clear third generation, and that they each take on a visual signifier, like they have a way of dressing or fixing their hair, or a color that they choose to wear, or some kind of accessory. Some way of sort of visually signifying which generation they're a part of. It seems like each generation kind of takes on some values that are important to them that weren't necessarily reflected by the preceding generations.
How did they refer to that? It's been a while. It's been over a year since I read the book. And how did they refer to that? Each person, they didn't use the word talent, but
their best.
Yeah. Okay. Yes. Their best.
That idea.
Yeah.
That everybody had their own best, and it wasn't like, it wasn't a generic thing. Like, it could be like, I make the best, this type of weaved basket. Like, it could be very, very specific. I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. And not necessarily dictated by, well, we need three chefs and and two carpenters or whatever, and so which one. It was more like what is it that you actually are the best at and naturally sort of interested in, and figuring out how to incorporate that into.
And it was, and it wasn't like, it didn't make you better than anyone. Everybody had their thing that they were, so
right.
That was kind of like the idea of everyone embracing the thing that they're very good at.
Yeah. It's kind of a sense, though, that that's made possible partly because of Stevelin's maintenance of the sort of their agricultural needs.
Yeah.
And so they don't have to be quite as you pragmatically focused on, we just need to make sure we have enough food for everybody, you know, on an ongoing basis. Any other themes or elements or characters, plot developments?
I mean, the character, the plot developments, the tension, you know, seem spot on that anytime you get a group of people together, they're going to have these kinds of rivalries. And the story doesn't attempt to, they're right on the surface.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, they do work to ensure their survival, but they all have their own agendas, or many of them have their own agendas.
Yeah, and as I recall, they're not all of those rivalries and conflicts aren't necessarily resolved narratively.
No.
Some of them are just resolved by a time jump. Well, it's now a generation later, and one way or the other, some kind of peace or compromise has been reached.
I thought it was also interesting. For a large chunk of the story, when they discovered this, you know, glassmaker society, they kind of build them up to be these amazing beings, and then when confronted, there's this challenge of, you know, communication, and then it kind of comes out that the glassmakers were badly malnourished, and you know, so they don't necessarily have the same capabilities as the original, or that the Earth colony thought that they would have. And so it kind of, I thought, brought up a lot of, I liked the idea or being challenged to think about how just having the simple basic needs provided for you can really limit how you can produce and create. And
right, we don't really develop a lot of art until we have some level of agriculture or something that, or just an abundance of food naturally, such that you don't have to spend all day every day just eating, or not eating, but securing enough food to eat, rather.
That's interesting. You pointed out that Stevelin ended up really in a heroic role. He worked to meet the food needs of the Earth, of the humans. What was his role in the decline of the glassmakers? Did he not like them, or started to withhold food from them, or made the city that they built inhospitable to them?
One of the things that, I guess, since I'm the one who's read this, like just finished it last week, one of the things that it seemed that I took away from it was that he wasn't sure what he did. He knew at that point he hadn't been able to communicate to the same degree that he was able to communicate with the colony from Earth. And so, and it seemed, the way I read him was that he genuinely was confused by what happened and wanted to learn. And so to me, that kind of, affected how he treated, or how he wanted to work with the colony from Earth, wanting to make sure that they were well cared for, even if, at times, it was looked at as possibly manipulative, I think that's one of the challenges to, like, the theme from the book of this mutualism. How much is mutual? How much is one person manipulating another, or creature, or,
Right, Right. Stevlin refers to what they're doing as domesticization or domesticating these various species, which, you know, has perhaps uncomfortable implications if you're the one being domesticated. And that I got a sense that there was the possibility, at least, that the glassmakers had kind of caught on to that and rejected it, that they were concerned that by accepting the assistance or food from the bamboo or from Stevlin specifically, and it's not, I don't think it's entirely clear the history there either, if there were other individual bamboo involved. But that, you know, if the glassmakers saw that help as being a little bit too costly in terms of what they were giving up in autonomy. And so that's why they moved away. And I don't think that's the definite answer of what happened, but I think there's the implication that that is one reading of it or one possible explanation for it.
Now, again, it's been a while since I read it, but in the climactic scenes, the glassmakers are the humans engage with the glassmakers and are providing them with assistance, but in the process of doing so, they're actually trying to break them of their destructive or violent tendencies. Am I remembering that correctly?
Yeah, I mean the way the book kind of ends up is that the humans collaborate with Stevlin to domesticate or redomesticate the glassmakers, but with some amount of knowing or informed consent on the part of the glassmakers.
And there's a group that remains outside of the city that doesn't. We've given away the end of the book, so to speak. But
I think we've talked about quite a bit of the plot, so I think
we've dropped spoilers.
A spoiler notification to the episode description. But yeah, you know, that does seem to be where it ends up. And so, yeah, is that consent the difference? Is it another generational thing on the part of the glassmakers that this is the way in which this new generation of glassmakers is setting itself apart from the decisions made by previous generations, that they're more willing to accept this arrangement? Is it the grass is always greener kind of situation where they're just going to always oscillate between, well, you know, we can see the problems with this way of doing it, so let's try the other way. Oh, nope, that way has its problems too. Well, since we've reached the end of the book, maybe that's a good place to wrap up our conversation as well, unless anybody has any last thoughts they want to get in.
No, thank you. It's a great book. I need to see if I can find a copy of Interference in the library, but probably I should go back and reread Semiosis before I read Interference, just to get a sense of the total narrative arc. But thank you very much for inviting me.
Sure. Thanks for coming. It was a good conversation, and I hope some other folks enjoyed it. If you want to let us know what you thought, if you have other books you'd like to discuss, or maybe even a book you've read that you'd like to come on and discuss with us, you can contact us at biobreakpod@gmail.com or at biobreakpod on Twitter, or you can search for Biobreak on Facebook. And the podcast itself is biobreak.podbean.com. And we'll talk to you next time. Bye.
Bye.